Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chance to visit with 97-year-old Dick Burbine of Bridgeport, California, the last survivor from the last Allied ship sunk by the German Luftwaffe in World War II, the Liberty ship SS Henry Bacon, which was operating between Norway and Russia in the Barents Sea 78 years ago.
February 23, 1945, the ship was 60 miles from the normal convoy. We hit a severe storm that destroyed our steering mechanism. The rudder and the main springs from the hydraulics split and broke. My job was at the time was pick up that 150-pound spring, put it back on, try to hold it in place while they were navigating the ship. We were a hazard to the convoy, so we had to drop out of the convoy. We were by ourselves 60 miles away from the convoy. So if anything happened, they would get us, but they would not destroy the convoy. And that's what happened. KG-26 found us with 23 Ju-88 torpedo bombers, one solitary ship. It was touch and go. What they did was they flew left or port or starboard of the ship. One row would float down the left or the starboard or port side of the ship and strafe everything one way. The other one would come in the other direction and strafe the other way. So consequently, when they did torpedo us, they hit us in number 5 hole and blew the whole side of the ship out at that point. We were under general armor for that time, and everybody's at their battle stations and whatnot. So what happened was, after blowing a hole in the ship, we had a matter of minutes before the ship was going to sink. Because as the ship was going down, it was blowing the bulkheads out between the hatches and so on. I was ordered by the chief engineer, Donald Haviland, my chief engineer, he was a full commander, 3-striper, to get into the lifeboat. And the lifeboats were all shot to pieces, except for that one lifeboat was still in fairly good shape. It had a few holes in it, strafe holes in it, but it was still seaworthy. The other ones were just about shattered. So he ordered me in there to cut the lanyards because it was frozen to the davits of the lifeboat. You see what davits are? Mm-hmm. And the lines were frozen to it, so the lifeboat would not go down by itself mechanically. So I got in the lifeboat with a fire axe, and I chopped one line down, and the stern was okay. Just as I was cutting the bow of the lifeboat, a sea hit us, and the lifeboat and I went over the side. Well, when I came to, I was in the bow of the lifeboat. The lifeboat come down the back of my neck, and I still have that hump in my neck to this day. But anyway, I came to in the lifeboat, kicked my sea boots out, and I was able to right the lifeboat. The lifeboat was upside down. I was able to right it. And consequently, that's where they put all the Norwegian 19 women, 19 children, the list is up there, into the lifeboat. And they wanted me to get in. Well, I knew that was crazy. If I got in that lifeboat, I would freeze almost instantaneously because I was soaking wet. So I said, no, I will not get in a lifeboat. And I stayed in the water. I was able to get the life ring. And during all this commotion, one minute I'd be 60, 80 feet in the air on top of a wave, on the crest of a wave, and the wave would break and I'd be down 60 feet below the water line. And I saw 2 seamen, a friend of mine, and I was able to push the lifeboat, swim with the lifeboat over to them, and I was able to save both of them. One of his name was William Wildridge, and the other one was Woodrow Wilson Posen, and one Navy gunner by the name of Warren Batchelor. And I was able to save all 3 of them. So, and when they picked us up, they took them aboard. When they dropped me on the deck, my eyes opened. They said, my God, they're still alive. And that's how they knew we were all still alive.
I don't know if you can hear the sound, but I think the sound is everyone's collective minds being blown by this story because it just seems so remarkable, so impossible. I want people to understand one thing you said. You got the women and children in the lifeboat. They're okay in the lifeboat because they're not wet. But because you're soaking wet, you know, if I get up there, I'm just going to turn into a popsicle.
That's exactly true. They tried to get me aboard. They tried to, because when I righted the boat, they brought the children down into the boat, the women and children. And they tried to let me come aboard. And I told them no, for 2 reasons. One, the minute I'm in that cold air, I will freeze to death. And 2, I'm taking place of 2 or 3 children. So consequently, I would not get in the lifeboat, and I did not. And it was almost, I would say, probably 73 or 4 years later, I was awarded the Norwegian full citizenship with ambassador privileges, and I was also awarded their Congressional Medal of Honor.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, that's what was coming to my mind, because I've interviewed several who've received our Medal of Honor in the U.S. and others who probably deserved it. But what you're talking about surpasses a lot of those Medal of Honor stories. How do you feel about it? I mean, you're telling us about this like it's no big deal. Do you realize how incredible or improbable or almost impossible what you did was?
I look at it, I was there at the time and I did what I had to do. And that's the way it was. I still feel the same way today.
I think what all of us try to do when we hear a story like this is put ourselves in your shoes. Maybe you didn't have shoes on at this point, but...
I see boots on. Uh-huh. When I was under the lifeboat. That's because they were tied up in the bow of the lifeboat with all those lanyards and whatnot. So I kicked my sea boots off, and I was able to free myself. And when I did, I surfaced, seeing the circumstances. The lifeboats, the other lifeboats were all sunk. The women and children were trying to come down. They had no place to go. So it doubled my effort to right that lifeboat. And I did, and I was able to put all, they were able to survive. When we got to Scapa Flow, King Olaf V of Norway met us there. He tugged me so tight that he almost brought tears to my eyes, and he had tears running down his face in gratitude. He gave us at that time one of the highest medals that they'd ever awarded, and it was the Norwegian Medal, War Medal. And 68 years later, I was awarded the Norwegian Congressional Medal of Honor.
And I'm sorry for keep bringing you back here, but I want to understand what this was really like. And I know it's 78 years ago, but we can tell your memory of it is still very clear. And 4.5 to 5 hours in the water, did that feel like an eternity? Was it going by quickly, slowly? What was it like in the midst of all of that chaos?
It was almost like a dead time zone, like your time stopped. To my knowledge, as my memory serves me right, I remember it was cold. I had a job to do, and I did it. And when they picked us up, they thought they were recovering bodies. That's how bad. I was on a life ring with 3 other people, Woodrow Wilson, Blackie Wieldridge, and Warren Batchelor, and myself. We were so low in the water, thank God, that the sea breeze would blow a crust of ice over us. We were in almost into a cocoon-type atmosphere. And that helped save our lives, because had we been exposed to that sea on a steady basis, we'd have probably all froze to death. But as it was, the ice sheltered us, and being the way from the shoulders down into the sea, our bodies were starting to crystallize. And when they brought us aboard, they thought they were bringing bodies aboard. And because of the ice on us, they dropped me, and my eyes rolled open. They said, "My God, they're still alive." And that's when they discovered the 4 of us were still alive.
It's one of those things, this has become a cliche, but I mean, if you wrote this script for a movie, no one would believe it, right? That's what this is. So what about you? You're a teenager. As you're in the water and your body is getting more and more frozen and time is going by, I mean, you have to start thinking you might not make it, right?
No, I never thought that.
Never.
I always thought I'm going to make it. I don't care what. I will survive. And when I spotted... 1 minute I'd be up there and I could see everything around me. The next minute I'd be down below the sea looking up a crest and you couldn't see anything. And I spotted these 3 different seamen that I told you about. And I was able to swim to each one of them with that life raft and save them. And when we got together and that ice cone froze over us, they thought they were picking up a life raft with 4 bodies. So, like I say, when they dropped me on the deck, my eyes opened and said, "They're still alive." They took us down to the mess deck, laid us on a table just like that, or their swinging tables. They went up to the officer's country and took bed sheets off the officer's beds, laid us on the table. They had to cut our clothes off, put the sheet over us, and they buried us in sea ice. They covered us completely with sea ice and let the body temperature melt the sea ice. It's the only way we'd survive, because they had no medication at all except for Fuster's Royal Navy rum. And the doctor at that time was a hell of a nice young man. He told us, he was a veterinary doctor before he served in the Royal Navy. And he said, "I don't have any medication at all. We've picked up so many survivors. I'm completely out of medication. But I have all the Royal Navy rum you can handle. Are you willing?" I said, "Hell yeah." And I've been drinking Royal Navy rum almost on a daily basis since then.
Well, it clearly saved your life. This is one of those where we need that disclaimer. You may not want to try this at home, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry that I keep bringing you back to things that maybe aren't as significant for you, but they're the questions that come up in our minds. As you're in the water for that long, hour after hour, clinging to these other guys, basically becoming a huddled mass of ice bobbing in the water, are you wondering, does anybody know we're here? Does anyone know we're alive? Are we ever going to get picked up?
The thought was, I hope we all get picked up, but it's not too likely, and I am not going to give up at all. I will never give up. So that's what was my thought was.
Were you even able to talk to each other, or was it too, yeah? What kind of things did you guys talk about?
We all mentioned the same thing. I hope we get picked up. Might not be likely, but we're going to survive. And our whole thought was survival. That was the most instantaneous thought in your mind at that time. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to survive, and I'll make it. And that's the way it was.
And I've talked to a lot of guys in situations like this, not exactly like this. I don't know if I've ever heard one exactly like this, but where it was extremely desperate. They knew they couldn't save themselves. Someone or something was going to have to save them. And some guys say, well, you know, we prayed and we really believed God was on our side. Other guys didn't have that kind of belief. What was it like for you guys in those moments?
Well, I can't speak for anybody except for myself. And my thought was from the beginning, I'm too young to die. I'm not going to die. And I'll survive one way or the other. And that was my sole thought. I will not give up.
And we know those other three wouldn't have made it without you, because you're the one that went and rounded them up and got them on the life ring. But have you ever wondered if you would have made it without them?
I didn't think about that at all. My thought at the time was, we're all together.
Yeah.
We're going to make it. Regardless what, we are going to make it. And we did. That was my solid thought all the way through. I'm not going to give up, and I'm going to make it. And I've all felt that way all the way.
And were you fully conscious and everything when they took you out of the water?
I'll put it this way. I was semi-conscious. You knew what was happening, but you didn't really appreciate how it was being done. By that, I mean we were to the point where we were almost semi-conscious. And we could see what was developing, but we didn't seem to be able to react to it. And that was it until when they dropped me on the deck. It sort of woke me up out of a daze, and then I realized, hey, we are saved. And that's the way it was. And that's when they said, hey, these guys are alive. My eyes opened up.
How much of your body could you actually feel? How much did you actually have sensation in?
That I couldn't even tell you. I have no description on it, because at the time, it was almost like you were floating, looking into your body. There was no feeling numbness or cold or anything else. We were to the point where it was blackout time. That's how close it was. Yeah. And like the doctor said himself, he said another minute or so, I wouldn't have to worry about you people, because the ice crystals were coming through the veins, through the body.
So he asked you if you want the British Royal Navy rum. So what did that feel like as those first few drops start to go through your frozen body?
It almost felt like a blowtorch going through your system. I presumed that our body was so cold that the shock of this alcohol going through the body, it felt like almost like it was a low voltage charge going through your body. That's the way it felt.
What were the hours and days that followed like? What kinds of stages of recovery were you progressing through?
Well, we were, from the time they picked us up to the time we went to Reykjavik, they took a lot of the people to Reykjavik Island, because they were to the point where they weren't going to save them. It was a matter of choice whether they took them onto the mainland of Reykjavik Island or not. I feel that had they not taken some of these people, that they would not have survived, because that's how far their body had deteriorated to the point where they just gave up. My personal experience was, I'm not going to give up, and I will not give up. And I didn't experience any of that. I just felt that it was a tingling, burning sensation as the feelings came back throughout your body. It was like you might freeze your hands while you're fishing or something of that nature, and it's slowly starting to thaw out. You have that tingling sensation. That's the way we were throughout, or I was, throughout my whole body.
You mentioned helping the women and children onto the lifeboat. What were they doing on this merchant marine vessel?
We'll go back to the beginning. The island of Sorøya is a whaling station in Norway. They produced fine whale oil. The Germans wanted it so desperately that they occupied the island and the 500 occupants of the island, and they took them captive. What happened was, when the British Navy found out about this, they sent five British destroyers into Sorøya, and they evacuated all the ones that wanted to leave the island. A few of them wanted to stay behind because they didn't want the Germans to take over their property and whatnot, so they stayed on the island. But over 450 of them were evacuated on those five destroyers. And they took those people, men, women, and children, that wanted to go to Murmansk. Well, when they got to Murmansk, Murmansk population was starving as it was. They had no place to put them, no food to give them. So they said, well, what are we going to do with these people? They decided to put as many on each ship that was in the harbor that could support those people on each ship. We ended up with 19 women and children on the ship. Consequently, when we got torpedoed, they were the first ones to be evacuated, put into lifeboats. Norma Peterson up there was the two-year-old little girl at the time it happened, and she's now a grandmother in Norway. She would correspond with the Navy people that saved her, and they would in turn tell me about her because they knew that she had been on our ship. And they would correspond with us and talk back and forth and with letters and whatnot.
It's time for our final break, but there's much more to come with 97-year-old Dick Burbine of Bridgeport, California. We'll hear about the man who saved his life 78 years ago and also some of his Marine Corps memories from the Korean War. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.